Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, it's your boy Johnny Bananas, and I'm going to be covering a brand new season of The Challenge USA on CBS that, of course, I will be completely dominating on my podcast, Death Taxes and Bananas, on the Ringer Reality TV Podcast. Head over to that feed and follow us on Spotify so you never miss an episode.
There's no better feeling than a personal win, and the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com, and joining me in the studio, fresh off his Sports Illustrated cover shoot, it's Andy Greenwald.
Whoa?
Yeah.
Whoa?
Andy Greenwald. Because that's the energy you're bringing. You're all positive.
Always.
You're all optimistic about the state of content creation.
Here's the thing. When we walk into the Faraday cage that is this studio.
That reminds me. I'm going to turn my notifications off.
All the negativity goes away because I'm talking to my buddy. I'm not on strike in here.
No. No, you're not. You're just giving everything you have to the man here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the man. Andy, today on the podcast, we're going to talk about a little bit of Winning Time, maybe a little bit of Linus, maybe some other surprise news at the top. And then I think we're going to hit on some fall TV preview. Mm-hmm. And I got you to watch a movie.
Yeah.
One of my favorite films of the year, How to Blow Up a Pipeline.
It's streaming.
It hit Hulu. And so I've adopted it as a watch product.
Uh-huh.
Fennessy is obviously talked about this on the big picture. But it's one of my favorite movies of the year. And I got you to watch it over the weekend. So you're welcome.
Yeah, no, I mean, I want to thank you. I also want to thank you for the opportunity to demonstrate once again for our listeners that when you ask me to do something, I watch it. Our Miyazaki pod is still not on the schedule, not calendared.
Honestly, the way things are going, we might as well put it on the board.
The drops of God continue to accumulate,
yeah,
making almost like a bucket at this point of God.
Mm-hmm.
That's there for you.
You
could swirl and spit anytime you want. You could just swirl and then you could spit and be like, not for me.
I'll check it out. Could I give you
a
roadmap to how to watch this season of Lioness since the first episode
Is it with my hands over my eyes?
No, it's saluting the flag.
Okay. Can I make one other just like a top of show kind of comment?
Sure.
So one thing that I didn't realize, speaking of saluting the flag, speaking of showing up for the man, a couple months ago, you were on one of your, 3 to 4 times per year trips to Europe,
mm-hmm,
where you go to take the waters, just get restorative bath, get your blood changed like LeBron.
Yeah.
And while you were away,
Magic Mountain style, baby.
Because again, everybody knows I'm Mr. Happy-Go-Lucky.
Sure.
I'm an easy guy. So while you were away, Kaya was like, would you do this ad read? And usually you keep me sheltered from commerce, right?
Right.
Which I appreciate.
Is that what you think it is?
Like a gift?
Yeah.
Or is it because I've been asked not to do that due to my radical views?
Go ahead.
So I did an ad read.
I'm aware of your ad read.
So what I didn't know, you know this, I guess, but because I hadn't done ad reads in a number of years, I didn't know that they really stay in the system for a while.
Yes.
So basically, I did this ad read in February, March, mm-hmm, when my older daughter had a biking trip with her school, and I was wrestling, as adults often do, with bike racks.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I made it seem like that was a really
was
big
it
deal.
An advertisement for bike racks?
No, it was an advertisement for beer.
Okay.
Which I love, but the copy was like, give a personal affirmation of something challenging you did recently that deserved a beer. And I was like, I did this yesterday.
Got up in America.
I know.
Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah.
Lived in the same country as the kids in How to Blow Up a Pipeline.
Yeah.
So now this has been going on forever, and I'm getting some feedback being like, wow, you really struggled with the bike rack. And I just want to come on the podcast a few months later and say, guys, I can put on a bike rack.
Oh,
like that's on lock.
So can I make a suggestion?
Drink more beer?
Let's say the strike continues unabated.
Yeah.
Ted.
Seems like
Donna,
it.
Bob, all the guys, they're just like, no, we're not going to cave.
You mean what's happening. Yeah.
You become TaskRabbit.
For bike racks.
Yes. Specifically for bike racks. And the only payment you ask for is an ice cold beer, no matter what time of day it is.
I love that. The payment part isn't going to work for me.
Because whenever I'm going on TaskRabbit and a guy is like, we'll take beer as payment.
Do they say that?
No.
I saw a couple guys who probably would have this morning in the Lessons parking lot.
Sure.
But,
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, so I just feel like there's something, but the bike rack thing does speak to something deeper.
Are you going
to
try and segue this into something? Go for it.
No, of course not. I'm just going to talk about myself more. I don't know if I've ever felt more conscious of mortality and human fallibility than I do during the time when I've attached the bikes to the bike rack and then I have to drive on a freeway
oh
for 10
God.
Minutes.
Yeah.
No matter how good a job I've done, and let me tell you, beer worthy recently. I feel like that must be what the passengers on the hijack plane would have felt like. Like every second, it could all go
sideways. You
know what
is funny is like when you're driving on the freeway behind a truck that seems loosely tied down, full of like old refrigerators and pitchforks.
Because and you see a sticker that says "This truck packed by a drunk TaskRabbit,"
and you're like, God, this would be like a terrible way to die because I can see it. It's
you
like,
see it. You have a lot of time to think about
it. You have
it.
The final destination thing playing in your head where you're like, boy, I can just see that pitchfork coming right into me.
And I'll feel so dumb in my last second.
Because I just changed lanes.
Because I knew. But then we had another piece. And I do think knowing your wife's automotive
history. And then
history,
you're just like, oh, Mike Lombardi, you made an interesting point there about the Bears. And then a pitchfork.
It's like, wow, Bill Walsh really. Yes, that was me this morning. But I also feel like maybe, I was going to say maybe only I have this, but I realize what it's, you know, I know Phoebe, you guys sometimes have a little friction on the highway.
Yeah, it's not our happiest place.
So what I was going to say is it's not just that then I am white knuckling it in the far right, like I'm driving on the shoulder to get to Pasadena, driving like 38 miles an hour. And, but the added thing is that my kids are like, everything okay, Dad? And I'm like trying to model like, you know, like confident, easygoing behavior. I'm like, it's great. Let me turn up the black pink a little bit more. Taste that pink venom. So yeah, trust me is what I'm saying.
I wanted to talk to you. We've kind of gone our separate ways. There's two paths have diverged in this wood, and I'm just really locked in on what's happening in Lioness right now. Penultimate episode came out last night.
Listeners should know that this isn't just Chris talking to you guys or Chris talking to me. Like any group chat I'm on with Chris is just riddled with Lioness references and drops now.
Well, because amazing things happen when you're not looking or when you are looking and you just have no one to talk to about
this. I'm not looking. And
on the sixth episode, or I think it's the sixth or seventh episode of Lioness, there is a scene where Zoe Saldana and Nicole Kidman walk into a room and across the conference table from them are Jennifer Ellie, Morgan Freeman, Bruce McGill and Michael Kelly from House of Cards.
Is it an intervention?
No, it's about whether or not she should have sent a kill team to massacre some Al-Qaeda guys who were hiding out in San Antonio.
What should she have sent to massacre them?
I just think that she's not supposed to operate on American soil.
Meant, like flowers.
If you saw Sicario, that's, you know.
She did a kill team on American soil?
Yeah.
Sick.
she got her guy, you know, so.
And by got, you mean?
He was removed from the situation called life. But I just couldn't believe it. You know, it's just an indication of where television has sort of arrived, where that caliber of names is just like in a scene together.
Yeah.
In a Taylor show on a Sunday night, maybe only with me watching. I don't know.
No, I think you and much of America is watching.
Okay.
Right? Do you feel that way?
I can't tell. I haven't gotten a lot of Lioness ratings feedback, but I feel like, yeah, I mean, I'm going to talk more about it, I think, once the finale airs next Sunday. So I think the maybe I'll do a full...
But shouldn't you do it with a microphone?
Well, I'm going to... Is it Labor Day? Technically, would be a holiday. So I don't know if I'm going to ask Kaya to, like, record us while I'm just, like, in episode 3 of Lioness.
I think you should do a 40-minute voice memo, just detailing your thoughts about the Lioness season, about America.
Yeah.
About labor.
I want to do it more like Campbell Scott and Singles leaving like answering machine messages from like different bars. Like, hey, Kaya, just another note about Lioness. Okay.
I think that'd be great.
But, you know, we both watched Winning Time.
We did.
So you want to talk about that for a few minutes?
Yeah, I do. I can't tell because we're totally divorced from reality and numbers and things. So I don't know how many people are watching this show. Like, what
you notice of- a real drop off in the ratings stories in Deadline and like and trades, like where they're like, this is what the show put up the other night. Is that a good sign or a bad sign?
Well, about which shows, and also like
all shows. Like, I don't ever see those articles anymore.
I think, I mean, first of all, talk about struggle. Talk about tweeting through it. Like the trades right now, it is dark.
It's like the trades, the FYC industry.
What's cool is they
finally, your consideration industry is like, oh yeah, there's crafts.
Well, they finally, they did a, these trade, the trade publications did a pretty good job getting in front of the strikes because they were banking interviews with actors so far in advance that I respect it. But I do think that particular well has run dry because now you're like making the world of Last of Us through craft services.
Yeah. Which is great that they're getting a look.
100% it's great, but that is not what they're hoping would drive content to their sites. Mm-hmm. But, you know, on the plus side, the AMPTP hired a new PR firm. So I think that they're going to start flooding these streets with more pro-Carol stories. I think that's going to be great.
She had a, there was a write-around profile over the other day.
There sure was.
Yeah, in the New York Times.
And there have been a bunch of, there was a thing in Deadline being like, actually, this is all going great.
Yeah.
So good job to that.
Carol's
PR
an
firm.
Avid golfer.
Terrific work, everybody. I don't know. I don't know whether it's because nobody can agree on what actually is a reflective.
Yeah, what's a number?
Number anymore. Yeah. Like there's a lot of, I think, semi, or at least fairly well-respected third-party aggregators of interest, but that doesn't, that's not the numbers the streamers are seeing. The streamers only share the numbers when they are incredibly favorable and, mm-hmm. And promote the narrative that they want to promote about biggest debut ever or whatever it may be. And this transparency actually, and we will get to winning time, but the transparency
is a huge part of the, what you guys are fighting for.
It's a huge part of the conversation. And I don't know, I don't know how that's going to shake out.
As an outsider, as a non, as a non-guild guy, can I just throw something at the wall for you? You can take or leave it.
Yeah.
Upload all shows to this social media platform X.
Uh-huh.
And just use views as a completely accurate barometer of its popularity.
I agree.
Okay, cool.
I think the social media platform X is just a place to get a really like just sober sense of
it's a marketplace of ideas. You know,
it's robust. So I think, you know, when we were talking about the strike stuff last week, we were talking about how the aforementioned guys, including Donna, met instead of countering the
guys
writers,
and Donna.
The guys and Donna, instead of countering the writer's proposal, the next meeting with the AMPTP was Ted and Bob and Donna saying,
should we say who these people are?
Bob for Iger, Ted Sarin, Bob Iger of Disney,
head of Netflix,
Netflix, Donna Langley, who's now taken over all of Universal. She was the film chief. Now she's in charge of television as well. They were like, this is a good deal. You should take it because people want to get back to work. Mm-hmm. They did not counter. They just said that the deal that they had offered on August 11th was the deal.
Yeah.
One of the points in that deal that has since been more publicized and ridiculed was that on the issue of transparency, because the writers and actors would like to know if they are participating in successful projects and feel and so that they can then say, I should be paid accordingly, which was the backbone of the residual market, which used to be why people got to buy houses in this town. The deal point in the AMPTP offer from, I believe, August 11th was they agreed to let three representatives of the Writers Guild come into a dark room and review numbers over the course of the next 3 years without ever talking about what they see. But at the end of the 3 years, when we have to do this all again, because these agreements only last 3 years when one is made, then the guild will be in a better position to understand the situation and negotiate forward from that.
Okay.
By the way, seems straightforward. Seems super on the up.
Is there any part of that that's like, there are some shows that get like seven people watching them?
Yes, that's where I was going with this. My point is, I don't think, I mean, there are definitely cases where books are being cooked or things are being hidden when people probably deserve a greater share of the success than it might otherwise seem. But I do think by and large, very few people are watching most of these shows.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if people saw the numbers, they would be shocked. And not only would they be shocked, I think that Universal shareholders or Warner Brothers Discovery shareholders would be appalled and riot. That doesn't mean that low numbers mean they're not meeting their goals because they have weird opaque goals.
And we've always talked about like there was an HBO model of like it needed to succeed in one of three sort of verticals of buzz, awards or viewership. Yeah. And if it could get all three, great. And if it could get two of the three, that's awesome. One of the three, one may matter more than the other.
For example, a documentary series called 100 Foot Wave was just renewed for a third season based on two viewers, I believe, us. Which is great for us, and thank you, Casey, for that.
But that's actually a good point where I was kind of just like, is this a singular obsession of me and Andy's and like a couple of people who tweeted us or something like that? And obviously, if you get a third season of, is that basically their drive to survive at this point?
No idea. Or is the cost, I mean, you also have to take into account it's a documentary. What is the cost of it versus a scripted series like Winning Time, which I promise we're about to get to. I think I say this not to throw water on the, I think, very necessary desire on the part of my guild to get transparency.
Yeah.
Someone on a showrunner thread I was on was making a point about, like, if you sell your socks on Amazon, not your used game-worn socks.
Sure. I just mean, like, that's a different site. Sock
your sock vendor. Amazon tells you how many people are engaging with it and buying it. If you put your app on the App Store, Apple communicates, shares data with you, and you profit off of that. The idea that we make things and then they just go into a bucket and a void and we never see them again doesn't make much sense. But I do think that there is a reckoning coming for this entire streaming industry, which is, what is it built on? Who is it built for? And I think full transparency would lead to a lot of crush dreams, as many crush dreams, if not more, than it would.
It would also have a profound effect on the kinds of things getting made. And I say that as somebody who watches a lot of YouTube, and sometimes when I read about the strike and I read about the state of Hollywood and I read about the incursion of tech into what were traditionally like Hollywood studios that did a very specific thing that was based on an advertising or subscription model, I wonder whether or not we're going to start seeing all of this stuff turn towards the way YouTube feels, which is not to say that there isn't good stuff on YouTube, because sometimes, honestly, if you ask me at the right time, I might be like, YouTube's more fun than watching actual television. But it's a very metrics-driven ecosystem. So you can tell that people who make similar videos to one another understand, oh, if I say the headline this way, if the thumbnail image is this. And like, there is a world in which TV starts to feel more and more like that, especially as these half a dozen streaming services have almost too much content to properly curate. Not that they're doing that great of a job of it in the first place on some of these services. We can always do a UX special, man. Don't worry about it. But couldn't you see a time where you're looking at Max and there's the thing that you're watching or the thing, like your homepage, and then there is an algorithmic right rail that's like, also, if you like this, there's this video and this video and this video.
I mean,
and you actually see the views.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that these companies, with the way they're oriented and certainly with the tech influence, despite YouTube being a tech company, I don't think they're that into transparency.
I know, yeah.
But I also think that
I'm just saying, if they were, I think it would change how people made stuff.
But also, I do think, and I am in lockstep with the guild in terms of what is being asked for, and, you know, I don't think I'm not deviating from what those goals are. But I also think it is important to understand that TV has shifted in so many ways. It's hard to do one-to-one comparisons between what the way things used to be and the way things are now. And we talked a little bit about Suits last week. Suits is designed to be approachable, to be popular, to be something that you can watch multiple times. You can casually watch, soft watch, as we coined last week, separate and apart from now it's on Netflix, so it's getting these new eyeballs. In the ecosystem that birthed Suits, although maybe that's an imperfect example, but Suits could have been pitched and aired successfully on NBC 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And during the ecosystem where that was the goal,
it's a very durable concept for a show.
Yes, yeah. Durable and approachable and appealing in terms of its tone. When that type of show was the goal and was king, there was no "I May Destroy You." That didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
There was no Fleabag. Maybe in the UK there was, but there wasn't here. And I think it is going to be, there's a reckoning coming in terms of the streaming model did allow and does allow for artistic flights of fancy. to say we're investing in a person and an idea that we do think is important to bring to market. Now, I've spent months railing against the people in charge who seemingly no longer think that's important, or their goals have shifted to gourmet cheeseburgers instead of just like appealing to awards class. So all that will shake out. But, you know, I don't want, as much as I do want transparency and I want writers to be fairly compensated and actors to be fairly compensated and all creatives up and down the line to be fairly compensated, I worry about a world where people are like, wow, look at the numbers on Reservation Dogs when you dig into the metadata. Mm-hmm. It doesn't justify its existence. And someone on, you know, an armchair person saying that because it is not as popular as Wednesday. I'm just pulling shows out of the air. But in what world is it ever going to be as popular as Wednesday?
Right.
What are we comparing? But I don't know how we do, I don't know how to articulate all this in a world where there are 450 shows with very different goals, all airing on services with very different goals.
So I guess now is as good as a time as any to talk about Winning Time.
Yes.
You wanted to chat about that?
I wanted to say two things in particular. One of which is so, it's, Adrien Brody is so good on this show.
He really is.
Jason Segel, who is on many shows and does a lot of work, kind of doing one of the best performances of his career on this show as Paul Weston.
In a role that is like, to be completely honest, I mean, regardless of whether or not it's a, it's a note perfect, accurate representation of what happened, that's a tough role to ask someone to take.
Yes.
Because not only, it's not like an anti-hero, it's actually a buzzkill. And Westhead in this show is like, you know, this guy, this guy, this guy, and this guy are going to make it. And you're watching this dude who thought he was the guy.
Yes. And I think that that speaks to what is emerging as one of the show's critical flaws. And I say this again, I say it every week, never going to miss an episode. Mm-hmm. Enjoy it week to week. But one of the critical flaws seems to me is this idea that we know who's going to make it. We know who's going to win and who's going to lose. And if there's any evidence that the show is popular, it's the autofill on Google, where if you just start to type Paul, it just says Westhead fired. Like it knows.
Right.
Or it knows people have been asking. But anyway, to say that if you
poke John Paul somewhere is just like, God damn.
I had it.
I was number one Google Paul. Paul the Octopus.
For so long.
Down so bad.
Paul Mescal coming up though.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, just a show where you kind of know all of those things, it is odd to me that it has steered so definitively into a hero narrative for the people who won. Like, the show is called Winning Time, so yep. Maybe it was already there. But it seems to me that if you're trying to make a show that will tell the untold story of a very, very, very told story, you might want to throw a little nuance on it, you know? And so I guess coming out of this episode, and this isn't still the point I want to make, so buckle up for this.
Gotcha.
But coming out of an episode where Magic is behaving petulantly, he asks to be traded, he's having temper tantrums, the show can't help but bend to him. I don't come out of, did you come out of this episode being like, boy, Magic is really fucking up. Like, he's behaving in a way that isn't befitting a superstar. I didn't. I was like, this system is failing him.
I don't really.
He has to win.
Watch it. I mean, because I know what happens. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm not.
Also, you are comfortable with moral ambiguity, as evidenced by your viewing of Lioness. You're comfortable with that.
My patronage of it.
Yeah.
It's not just viewing.
Yeah.
I don't really watch it with like a rooting interest. I mean, definitely not with a rooting interest because I don't like the Lakers.
Yeah.
But I don't think that I watch it and think about how people got in the way of greatness. You know, of Magic. It does an interesting job, you know, where it's just like watch Magic almost fumble the bag here, or almost throw away what we all know what happened here. But I guess, to be completely honest, like my historical ninniness about it is starting to get a little bit in the way of it.
Meaning like you just know it wasn't quite like that. Like last week's
episode.
Or
it's just like, I mean, I think it's just like part of the Jerry West stuff, and I start to get a little bit curious about, like, is Westhead really like that? You know, is Riley always completely right in the suggestion that he was trying to make? You know, like, it's just a very complicated history.
But you must have been happy to see Gillian Jacobs back on the show.
I sure was.
For
shout out to Chris Riley.
8 seconds.
Yeah.
Watching him writhe around on the floor. hopefully she'll be back for more.
Good to see Kurt Rambis, too, getting represented on the show.
Rambis, Kupchak, like, all
I think Kurt Rambis should take over as GM of the Lakers.
You think now or then?
Yeah, no, now.
Really?
Yeah.
You don't think Pelinka's doing a good job?
I think Harden for LeBron's right there.
Here we go.
Harden for AD and Austin Reeves. That's that feels fair.
Who says no?
Yeah, that feels fair. Who says? Not Kurt Rambis.
It's Rambis slander. First on the show and now this. The thing that I was going to say that was so striking to me was Winning Time is an imperfect vessel for this argument, but in some ways it's what we've got, which is to say no one has any idea what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I say that is this is a show that has a large amount of history to potentially play with. And as we've been saying every time we cover it, there were rumors, or it was even supported in some of the creators talking about it in the early days, that this show isn't limited to the Showtime Lakers. Like, no. At a certain point,
I think there was a tease of like this could go through up to LeBron. Like,
yeah, it could go Kobe and Shaq. It could do all of these different eras. The show laid down a card in its first episode by beginning
in 84.
Not this season.
Oh yeah, it began with Magic's announcement.
Magic's HIV announcement in the first season. So, without any other speculation as to the future, this show has said, this is the story we're telling of drafting this kid to that incredible earth-stopping moment. Because of that, I'm finding it really perplexing that we are spending this much time in the disappointing Westhead years before Riley takes over and it becomes Showtime. Like, the show is behaving like it's the Crown.
Uh-huh.
It's behaving like there was a handshake deal, like the one there wasn't between Daryl Morey and James Harden, saying, take your time, really explore the richness of this text because you've got 8 years.
But isn't that the pitch of the show, is how the Lakers right before they were really great? I mean, I know it's just the story of the Lakers, but it seems to be like, isn't it about the bus stewardship of this franchise?
Yeah, it's just acting real, real confident in the hand that it's holding and how much time it's got at the table.
I'm personally...
Which is odd to me, because it is not... This show is getting further than any show I can think of on the strength of its IP, on the strength of its incredible cast, which, you know, I'll say, Adrien Brody is so good. That guy won an Oscar and dicked around for 2 decades. Now, all of a sudden, he's realized, oh, this is what I can do. I can just show up and dunk on people in Succession, in a Wes Anderson movie every now and again. Not a bad career. Anyway, it's acting just real confident in a way that I think is also harming the storytelling, because we're just swimming along. We sure know how Jerry West is going to react to this. Last week, Norm and Magic fix it all up. This week, they're mad again. Okay. All right.
I think what you need...
Me?
What we need is a For All Mankind-esque time jump,
mm-hmm.
but like past the present. Into the future.
Yes.
Dr. Jerry Buss as Dr. Manhattan on Mars.
I fucking love it.
You know, looking down on the NBA. It.
Yes. This is, I mean, you had me at...
Basketball in space.
You had me at For All Mankind time jump. What about alternate history?
Oh, yeah. One where Magic gets traded to the Sixers.
What if next week Magic gets traded? This would immediately vault.
Oh my
pantheon.
God. This show would be like the only thing people talked about for 4 days. And then I think everybody would be like, what the fuck are we watching?
I would be so into it. If there was a show that was essentially the Bill Simmons trade machine hour,
yeah,
right. And it just played it all
what ifs?
Out.
Yeah, just straight up what ifs.
And then
Kawhi Leonard on the Pacers.
Season 9, we don't draft Markelle Fultz.
Yeah.
And it's just for us at this point. It's just this. Maybe this is where the AI stuff is really going, and I should rethink my opinion, where Casey can just make 100-foot wave season 3 through 24 and fix the process Sixers for us. I'm in. Who says no?
I was thinking about Winning Time when I was putting together our fall TV preview.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, they often stuff will get announced a little bit out of nowhere, or maybe it's not on like a bunch of the lists, or it just hasn't gotten a release date yet. So they're waiting to sort of announce specifically in October or November. And I think you and I have a fair amount of confidence that the True Detective season is going to come out in the next couple of months.
Everything we've been led to believe is, or been told, is that.
But
it's
I will say that when I was putting together this list, I was struck by the at least not scheduled next big. And I will call it HBO-esque because it's a Max show. It would be a Max show. But the next big HBO kind of Sunday night show.
Because I think, and we can do full disclosure here, I believe, you didn't say this, but maybe I'm also psychoanalyzing, that one of your reasons you wanted to compile a fall TV preview was kind of like sending out a rescue flare. Like, is there something that we can become heliocentric about?
I was more doing it because September is next week.
That's a tough beat for me. But except school starting, which is a great beat for me and the children that are currently chilling in the Spotify green room.
But I was, you're right. I was kind of like, show me the way. Mm-hmm. What's going to happen? I think, you know, Sean and Amanda talked about Dune moving to 2024 on their podcast today. And I don't know if you have any strong feelings about that one way or the other. I feel bad for, frankly, Denis Villeneuve, who's had one movie swallowed up by the pandemic and another movie moved like into March.
Yeah, but then he gets microphones in front of his face and he's just like, but what if there was a Dune part three?
But there is like Dune 3, 4, 5.
Relax. Just relax. Finish your story.
My story?
No, Denis, like finish your story, you dork. Like, you know what? I know there are a lot of paperbacks, but like...
I think he wants to do like...
God Emperor of Dune?
No, he wants to do the third one because it's like, what if Paul... wasn't great that Paul became this guy.
What if Paul was traded to the Bucks? Like, is that the alternative?
We just want to live in a world where Paul Atreides outranks Paul Westhead.
Yes, that's a great point. Yeah. Why was Paul Atreides fired? Why couldn't Paul Atreides get along with his star player,
the Worm?
You don't mean Dennis Rodman. You mean
the giant sandworm.
Are they on the same? Oh, they are going to be on the same team.
Yeah, he's fucking talking to them in the trailer.
All right, but in the first movie, they're not on the same team.
No, it eats the harvester, and like then he pulls that like hot move where he's just like, oh, I'm going to wait for the last farmer.
Get over here, worm.
Yeah.
Come here.
You fucking worm.
You're a big worm.
Why are we doing this? Why are we doing like a big improv bit about
the podcast?
I wanted to do a fall TV preview because I wanted to see a roadmap.
The other thing about, there was one other thing about Dune that was interesting in that the last time we talked about, we don't do it often, we talked about a movie getting delayed. It was Challengers.
Yeah.
Right? The Luca Guadagnino movie that Zendaya stars in as well.
Yes.
And one of the reasons
why. I guess Zendaya's social media is incredibly important.
That's what
films.
I'm saying.
Yes.
That they absolutely did this because of her follower count. Like, she is such a asset.
Yeah, because you know what? The weird thing is that obviously people want to go to the movies. We just got through a situation, a summer where two films will probably gross $2 billion cumulatively. Mm-hmm. Clearly, there's an appetite. People went and saw Gran Turismo. There's movies out there to go see. Certain kinds of movies don't do well, maybe. Like, you know, maybe like R-rated comedies aren't hitting anymore. But I think people would be like, yeah, Dune, I saw the first one. I'll go see the second one.
Yeah, I don't get that, honestly. It is probably going to be really good. It has a lot of really good actors in it. People liked the first one. I think there was also some stuff like that, for example, there's a galaxy brain version of this where you're like, Warner Brothers actually knows it's going to be good, but their market position and profits are so good this year because of Barbie. That if you push Dune 2, they can boost next year's.
Barbie like wiped off all the red off the books?
Barbie is making so much money.
Yeah, but like that much money? How much isn't aren't they like really in the red because of the acquisition and starting Max and like
I'm not a fiduciary.
Yeah.
I don't actually know how
you're just a task rabbit.
Money works. I just get paid in beer and it's delicious. I'm not saying that Barbie was so successful that David Zaslav is now making a profit on Max. That is not the case. But I don't know. That was just a stray comment that I saw that it may be related to success as opposed to failure. It also could be that it wasn't done. And they want to preserve a relationship with Denis and give him more time. I think it's done too.
Yeah.
But
I think he was like, this movie as of last week was coming out in November.
But I'm still looking, I'm still smarting over the Spider-Verse bullshit where they were like, because of the strike, we must take the third Spider-Verse movie off of the schedule. See what you did, writers and actors. And it's like, there is documented proof that they haven't even started that thing yet.
Right.
So, okay.
Documented proof. That would be good if you were like investigative journalist about Spider-Verse.
I'm Seymour Hersh of Spider-Verse. And my facts are too hot for mainstream media, so I'm gonna have a Substack.
Into the Spider-Hersh. That's you.
See, this is why there's only ever gonna be one of these podcasts ever again. Because that joke That's a perfect joke.
Okay, so here we are. It's Monday, August 28th.
Yeah.
The next big kind of batch of shows starts coming out, I guess it'll be next week. Mm-hmm. September 8th, The Changeling on Apple, which stars Lakeith Stanfield.
That's exciting.
First couple episodes are directed by Melina Matsoukas, who I'm a big fan of her work. And it seems like, mm-hmm. based on the trailer, this might fit into the lane where Servant was, the M. Night show. That's mm-hmm. kind of a little bit horror, a little bit fable-y, but mm-hmm. like pretty cool looking. So I'm looking forward to that. That's September 8th. And then you get a barrage of stuff. Welcome to Wrexham, which I have.
Do you watch that?
I will watch this season. And this is kind of interesting because now for me, and I think for most people who watched the first season, that was their introduction to Wrexham. Like they had never really thought about this lower league
yeah.
football team in the UK in Wales. And so now like they're like, okay, like I'm in. This is about a season that has already happened. Just like Drive to Survive.
Right.
Will air episodes of the F1 races that people who follow F1 know who wins.
Oh.
Right. So well,
but even if I ever Googled the name of a surfer from 100-foot wave and wrote like Nazare injury, like
yeah.
I would spoil upcoming seasons.
Sure.
But I won't do that.
Right. But if you like have looked at ESPN, you know what's happening with Wrexham. So
I see.
I think that it'll be interesting to see the reception to this season. That being said, they're much bigger this year. This show has really caught on, I think, with a lot of people. And I will just say there's some stuff in this season that they're documenting that I cannot wait to watch shown on television in this way.
Ryan Reynolds, very successful guy, right?
Yeah, he's really diversified his portfolio.
Did you listen to when Bill was talking to our pal Jacoby and Kevin Wilds, and they mm-hmm. were talking about maybe Jimmy Butler's just right about everything and we should drink Michelob Ultra
yeah, I didn't
and
agree
drink
with
his coffee?
Take. Yeah.
You still a little sore?
I'm like...
You hate heat culture.
I just don't really like Jimmy that much, honestly.
Wow. I was only saying it that maybe Ryan Reynolds is the Jimmy Butler of entertainment. I don't like anything that he
does. Has he destroyed multiple franchises that he touched?
I don't think it was his fault.
Who, Jimmy or Ryan?
Do you think Jimmy destroyed the Sixers?
I think Jimmy had some deleterious effects on the Timberwolves and Bulls after his exit from there.
I think he's just a truth teller.
Okay.
I think he's just a blacklight. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Like he just exposes the fractures that are already there.
The Morning Show comes back on September 13th. Jon Hamm in one of two shows that he'll be on this fall. Mm-hmm. We'll get to the other one soon. That seems to be about, speaking of things that happened in the past, it seems to be about the Sony hack.
Great.
But is applied to this fictional news network. Aniston's still there. Reese still there.
Put that on the poster. Aniston's still there. The Ringer.
Here's one thing that I'm kind of curious about. Uh-huh. You're not going to be curious about it.
Probably not.
The Continental, which is a three-part mm-hmm. event series on Peacock that is a John Wick prequel about the young version of the Ian McShane character in John Wick. Have you ever seen a John Wick film?
No.
Do you have any interest in seeing John Wick films?
Kind of. I mean,
I think you would enjoy 4, except for the fact that it's 2.5 hours long.
I really, this is not me being precious. I don't have any problem.
This is not like Lioness Andy.
No.
Right.
I think the politics of John Wick align with mine a little more than Lioness. So I think I'm comfortable with it.
I don't know about that.
I don't know about that either.
You don't even know what's happening in Lioness. It could be like basically a James L. Brooks movie. You wouldn't know.
I'm pretty confident that it's not.
It's not. It's not. I think one thing I do want to do is like write down the 10 wildest things that happen on Lioness and just read them to you and see your face. The Continental, Colin Woodrell plays young Ian McShane. Mel Gibson is also in this.
I think you need to read what you wrote in the notes that
your,
you shared.
Your boy Mel Gibson is also in this too. It's set, I think, in 70s NYC, which I think is neat. Mm-hmm. The trailer certainly suggests it has lots of John Wick style action.
So other
people... My main thing is 3. Cool. I'm interested in this.
So John Wick, he's really good at fighting and he loves dogs, right?
He is the greatest. He's like literally a god almost. That's
my understanding is that he's the best at doing it.
So, and he doesn't just really love dogs. A Russian mob kills his dog.
Yeah, and that starts the whole thing.
Yeah.
See, I know.
Yeah.
Look at me.
Yeah.
After I finish strapping a bike rack to an electric vehicle, I can get down with an action movie. My question is, are other people also super fighters? He's not.
He's not super.
in the non-MCU of John Wick, he's super. He's
elite.
He's
like a blue chip guy. Yeah, he's a 5-star player. Right. You know, and he happens to wear blazers and sport coats that I think are somewhat bulletproof.
Oh, I thought you meant like a Dame Lillard jersey.
No. Yes.
Got it.
Starstruck comes back. I haven't really watched it. Yep. I got to be honest. It's Juliette Lewin's a huge fan. I just haven't checked it out. I wanted to take your temperature on Gen V.
Yeah.
Because personally, I'm good. I don't need a boys spinoff. And I say that as somebody who just 5 minutes ago was like, you know what? John Wick, I'll do that spinoff. But the reason why I'm into the Wick thing is 3 episodes.
Yeah.
I already find boys seasons to be rather long.
Do you?
Yeah.
I don't, because they're only 8 episodes and they drop 3 at once. And then I'm like, oh, it's already done. Well, the episodes are long.
I find the episodes to be long. And I think a lot of the times I'm like, I know where this is going.
But I also think, again, for me, I find it really flattering to watch the boys because I see my politics reflected so keenly in Homelander, you know? So that's what I seek out when I like entertainment. No, did they finish their 4th season?
I have no idea.
That's a show I really like. I have mixed feelings about this, and we'll just have to check it out because the idea is a solid one. They're taking a page from the X-Men playbook, which is like, what if X-Men, but young?
Yeah, New Mutants,
school,
right?
New Mutants. That's the same thing. That was the first spinoff of X-Men, basically.
I also think high school is probably ripe for the comedy of the boys. Like, I'm sure they can...
I do have some built-in skepticism that I will say again as a caveat, like, it might be good. It might be good. And I would love to be surprised. I just have this natural skepticism now of things like cart before horse shows, which is Amazon saying, we are going to do a Vought televised universe.
Yeah.
And we're going to make all these spinoffs. And they greenlit the spinoff without a show.
But you don't know that they did that?
They did that.
Okay.
I think that's not a secret. I mean, they didn't film Blank Pages. They workshopped and they brought in people.
Nobody went up to Jeff Bezos with tears in their eyes and said, sir, I've been working on this spec script for the last 2 years about what if the boys was in high school.
What if boys but young.
Yeah.
So I just am never really, I just don't think that's a good precedent, even though that is precedent for how
the industry
works.
Sometimes when I'm like in coffee shops in LA and you see a guy with like wireless headphones staring at Final Draft and like a studio, and you're like, young William Goldman over here. Mm-hmm. Hope someone sees the vision. Mm-hmm. And it's funny to imagine that person writing like a boy's spec script.
Spec scripts. Like, then he shrinks and goes inside the other guy's dick. Fade out.
Seymour Hersh goes into the Spider-Verse.
It's a beautiful town and a very healthy industry.
Hold on. I'm going to start crying. That's so funny. October 6th, my wife's birthday, Loki season 2 starts.
Happy birthday, Phoebe. Have you already told her how you're celebrating her birthday?
I don't know that she could identify Loki in a lineup of just Loki that said a sign on him that said Loki.
Well,
then to be fair, there's lots of Loki.
There's lots of Loki. There's a fucking alligator Loki. So
that's true. She would probably be pretty charmed by that. Season 2.
She does like animals.
Trailer was pretty cool,
yeah.
I guess. The Majors piece hovers over all of it. Yeah, so are you...
I really hope it's good. I really want it to be good. I want them to stop the bleeding.
Yeah.
And I am going to go into this with as open a mind as I have gone into any Marvel project because they'd earned it. First season earned it. Good show.
Did you see there was like a... Honestly, you may have sent this to me because what you do now is...
Here we go.
You screenshot...
Yeah.
Meta newsfeed mm-hmm. updates.
I don't want to give them the click.
All the comic book sites that you don't go to.
Never.
And then you send me the headline and I'm like, what's the answer? And you're like, oh, I didn't click.
Yeah. Do you like that?
I just don't think it really lends itself to a lot of good conversations.
Well, mostly it's jokes.
But I saw one of those kind of things where it was like, Marvel confirms WandaVision season 2 not happening. And I was like, isn't she... She's not dead, right?
I don't know.
Oh, she's dead, right?
Sure. Well, I mean, Elizabeth Olsen has put the character into a body bag with her comments about being involved in that enterprise. So,
yeah,
I don't think... But I mean, that was like a you can't fire me, I quit kind of things, I think, for Marvel.
Gotcha. You know? After Loki, we've got the fall of the House of Usher.
But like, you ever just take a moment and just think about the fact that there's a Agatha show?
Yeah.
That like Catherine Hahn and Aubrey Plaza spent part of their year just being like, yeah, let's do this. Let's do the spinoff of WandaVision. Like, let's really get into the
coven. In a cool way?
No, that's crazy to
me. Will you go into Agatha with as open a mind as you view Loki?
That's up to Loki.
Okay.
Isn't it?
Fall of the House of Usher.
Tell me about this. I'm just learning about this from your
I feel like messaging. I've gone on the Mike Flanagan Odyssey solo. It's not really, you don't like her. Mm-hmm. You certainly don't like incredibly slow-paced her. You're more of like
I don't like it when you ask me to do things.
Frantic, found footage kind of guy.
Kind of.
This is an adaptation of the Edgar Allan Poe banger that we all know and love. I got to be honest, I don't think I've ever read this.
Really?
I got to be completely real with you right now.
This is fine. This is what this is for.
I may not have ever read a single word of Edgar Allan Poe.
Oh, come on. You've read Telltale Heart.
Nope.
The Cask of Amontillado.
I know what it's about. I know what happens in it, but I don't think I've ever cracked an Edgar Allan Poe.
I mean, the like Cask of Amontillado is like 25 pages and a short story.
I don't have to tell you. I'm being honest with you. I thought I could do that.
Wow. Give me
a canonical author that you've never read a single word
of. Have you ever watched a Baltimore Ravens game? I feel like that's
yes.
Poe canon.
I wonder how much Poe Mal knocks out.
Do you know what's
really... Because they claim him pretty hard.
Do you know what's sad?
What?
If you start to type Poe, it just autofills Dameron in episode 10. That's a tough look for Edgar. That sucks for him, honestly. What's a famous author that I haven't read? There are definitely some.
The Bible.
I read every word. You know who I've never read a word of? I think I just admitted this to you, although this is not going to be... No one's going to aggregate this. I've never read a Joyce Carol Oates book. She's written like 80
canon.
Books.
Yeah, so what? Like, give me like a... Somebody before the 20th century.
Incredible. But as someone who last week was like, I'm never going to write a novel. And this week, I'm like, Joyce Carol Oates has written 80 bangers. And you're like, so what?
No, because I said I didn't read Edgar Allan Poe. And you're like, oh, I've never read Oates. Like, but that makes it sound like everybody before that.
I've read.
Yeah.
Everyone else.
You read Moby Dick?
No.
Yeah. You ever start it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot about,
I think
like,
it's pretty good.
Fish.
It's really whaling. Good.
Did you read it?
Yeah.
Do you read it during the pandemic?
No, I read it before that.
Like in your life? Like when in your life? You're being real cagey about this.
I read it like read one it
in,
summer. I can't remember. It was
in
like
prison?
17, like, 16, yeah.
Wow.
2017 or 16. It had been a long time. I had never read it during school.
But like, not to do a callback to last week, except this is a callback to last week. If I ever find myself exiled to Belarus for staging a coup against Vladimir Putin, I would read Moby Dick. Like that's the time for it. That's when you can read it.
Oh, you're one of those guys who's like, if I go to jail, I'm going to get super, I'm going to read all the great books.
I just feel like there will be a time very soon, if anyone's listening to this podcast, where people won't come to me with a microphone and money and be like, talk about this. So I'll be like, I guess it's time to return to the canon.
The thing is that Mike Flanagan has figured this out for us because it's not a true to the text adaptation. It's updated and set
this.
In the world of Big Pharma. And stars Bruce Greenwood and Carla Gugino, who were in his Stephen King adaptation, and Zach Guilford. I'm excited for this. Less excited for Frasier coming back, but I was just never a Frasier guy. That's on Paramount Plus.
And if I'm correct me if I'm wrong, David Hyde Pierce is not back for this, right?
I honestly wouldn't make it.
Can you have Frasier without Niles, Chris? In this economy,
is Frasier one of your big sitcoms?
No, but it was good.
Okay. October 13th, Lessons in Chemistry, also on Apple. Apple has quite a few shows on the fall.
Well, this is when Apple gets to flex. This is why Apple has not been that. You haven't really heard like the head of Apple or Tim of TV or Tim Cook being like, we must end this strike. I think they're
because
fine.
He's like, we have 10 shows coming out.
I think they're fine.
Yeah. So,
and even if they didn't have shows, they'd be fine. Lessons in Chemistry is the Brie Larson show based on a best-selling book that my buddy Zach Galler worked on and has said good things about.
Did you read this book?
I did not.
Okay.
But when we were away this summer, an adult asked my 10-year-old daughter what book she's reading. And she was like, this book about warrior cats. I've read 33 others. And she was like, oh, interesting. Have you read Lessons in Chemistry? And I was like,
weird.
That's what I said.
Yeah.
And I had to be like, I always want to like cater to strangers. I was like, oh, sounds interesting.
Right. Is that why like when I like opened the door for you and your daughters, mm-hmm. you were like, we were just talking about you.
Because you're a stranger and I was flattering you? No, they were asking quite reasonably why I do not have access to the Spotify buildings and you do. And I was like, Chris works here. And they were like, he does? And I was like, yeah. But I didn't get to interrogate that tone.
Okay.
Like, were they like so impressed? Or were they like, that's beneath him. I don't know.
Well, like, let me know what they think.
I will.
All the light we cannot see is something that does not look up my alley. It's Mark Ruffalo on a Netflix show, a limited series adaptation of Anthony Doerr's kind of magical realism, I would describe it, a story set during World War II.
You didn't read this book.
Yeah, there's like an orphan, and it's like, whenever you start with like an orphan and there's like a circus and then there's a blind guy, like I'm always just like, man, it's time to go back to Lioness.
That
give me things I can touch and feel.
When you're describing this, it makes me want to also watch Lioness. Isn't this Sean Levy?
Yeah.
Like Night at the Museum guy being like,
yeah. Okay. I think this is like a dream project for
it
him.
Is. This was featured in.
And Mark
the big,
Ruffalo is now, quote unquote, on TV, which I guess he was in She-Hulk, but.
He was very much on TV on She-Hulk. This was the gourmet part of the cheeseburger menu in the, I don't know if it's famous, but we talked about it a lot, the Bella Bajaria, the head of content for Netflix, profile in The New Yorker. They were like, she's not just a fixin's bar, she's also fully invested in this.
Yeah.
Anthony Doerr, huh? So add him to the Joyce Carol Oates pile.
Okay.
Never read him either.
Just a couple other things. I want to, because there's a couple down here that I really want to get to.
Okay,
so Buccaneers on Apple comes out November 8th.
Can we say what? This is an adaptation of an unfinished Edith Wharton novel.
Tim Cook's just like, I have to burn this cash.
For real.
Nah, I think this might be cool. But that Apple is just like, yeah, man, unfinished Edith Wharton novel.
When I hear that, I'm like, this is really big Walter White, let's open a car wash energy. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Adaptation of...
Turns out people really want iPhones.
Have they not adapted the finished one? Like, there must be a finished one they haven't gotten to yet. Like, we haven't revisited Ethan Frome through a modern lens. Not since Liam Neeson went down the hill in the sled. So, all
that's
of a
Ethan Frome?
Yeah. Did you not read that either?
Moby
Dick?
I thought that was... Is there a sledding in Little Women? I know she didn't write Little Women. I'm just saying, like, where's the big sled scene? That's Ethan Frome?
Yeah.
Okay. We're really getting behind here. The one that I'm most excited for is November 14th, The Murder at the End of the World.
Yeah.
This has been my thing I was looking forward to in August, and FX moved it into November. It's Britt Marling's new series starring Emma Corrin and Clive Owen, and it is essentially... I mean, for the sake of easy description, a Agatha Christie meets Alex Garland type of tale, I think. I'm not sure about that, but that's how it feels. And Clive Owen is a billionaire and Emma Corrin is a detective-esque character, and there's a murder on a resort. And it sounds really cool.
Can I also just give a small tip of the cap to the marketing team at FX? Mm-hmm. I don't know them. I don't even know who we're speaking of when I say this, but like, this show isn't an easy sell, I don't think, because, you know, it's Britt Marling. She made the OA. She doesn't make generally big popcorn things. It's not based on IP. But between the title and the poster, which is really striking, it's Emma Corrin standing there with Clive Owen sort of looming behind her. I'm like, this is communicating a vibe to me and makes me want to see it.
Yeah.
That stuff still matters.
That's all we ask for. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you, are you going to watch the Scott Pilgrim anime show on Netflix?
I'll check it out. As someone who, I'm an early Scott Pilgrim adopter? Do you know this about me?
Yes, I know that.
I own the original art of the first page of the first book. Because I met Brian Lee O'Malley years ago.
Did you try to get Joyce Carol Oates to sign that at the most recent?
No, I just told her that she should do something more interesting. Like write about Canadian kids and bands. I'll check it out. I mean, I think I'd be interested in a new story rather than an animated version of a story that was done pretty well, but yeah,
okay.
Sure.
Fargo comes back, season 5, John Hamm in the mix. Juno Temple looks like it's getting back to Fargo roots.
Good cast.
I'm looking forward to that. That's FX. That's at the end of November. Echo comes on 11/29.
Just in time. You're sitting down with your turkey and you get to watch this turkey.
And then there's a couple of big ones that are just kind of undated, but they're lurking.
Okay.
The Crown season 6. For All Mankind season 4. This is the one that I'm most jacked for. And this is another shout out to Tim's, shout out to Eddie, shout out to everybody at Apple. Godzilla universe spinoff with Kurt and Wyatt Russell called Monarch:Legacy of Monsters.
It's incredible.
That could be a good show.
It could be a show. I mean, that's wild. That's just a TV show.
I now feel like I have to go back and like kind of dig into the Monsterverse. To see what I've missed about the Monarch organization.
Oh, that's the name. So this is, when you say Monsterverse, these are the recent Godzilla movies that have some sort of overarching.
Yeah, and there's like, oh, and then the Monarch organization are the ones that like got Godzilla woke them up.
Oh, that's great. I always, my understanding of Godzilla was what it lacked was like a really like central narrative. Like an origin story. I just want more.
Well, the thing, you go to Godzilla for the people, you know?
Yeah, it's like the Playboy of giant lizards.
Mr. and Mrs. Smith on Amazon with Donald Glover and Maya Erskine, Gilded Age. Did you watch Gilded Age?
Age has been dated, by the way. You're acting like people don't know.
I mean,
Gilded Age is roaring back October 29th.
Okay. I'm pretty pumped up for that.
Did you finish Gilded Age S1?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You are the most reliable customer. I like to
watch TV
content
with my wife, and she is just like, let's watch a show together. And then this show Sugar with Colin Farrell as a detective on Apple.
You had me at this show.
All Apple is doing is producing all of the technology that we use and making Colin Farrell detective shows.
It's a trippy detective series. It's like a sci-fi thing. Fine.
That's the fall of 2023.
That's my good friend from the picket line, Colin Farrell.
I know. You guys got papped together.
Yep. Just two guys fighting for justice.
Should we talk a little bit about how to blow a pipeline before we get out of here?
Yeah. So we just went through that. Like, do you feel optimistic about this fall? Do you feel...
I like to do these things just to get a lay of the land.
Yeah.
But one of the coolest things about doing this job is I didn't see industry coming.
Right.
I didn't see X show coming. And it was like, oh, I'll give this a shot. So like, there's a show called The Gold that's on Paramount Plus in a couple of weeks that stars Jack Loudon and is about like a gold heist in London in the 80s. Like there's, I want to be open to the possibility that a show can come out of nowhere and just rock my world. So,
I hope so too.
There's probably something here that I missed or probably something that might get a date and be announced all of a sudden. In the meantime, is there something on this list that I'm like, I've been waiting my whole year for this? I don't think so. I don't think so. True Detective is probably the closest to that.
But it does, this has happened before. Maybe there's just a brighter spotlight on it because of the state of the industry and the strikes. There's nothing on this list that has us like doing the meme of the guy in the yellow suit standing behind the tree rubbing his hands.
Yeah, that meme.
Like, I love memes, so I just wanted to shout out some of my favorite memes.
That's one of my favorite Edgar Allan Poe is the man in the yellow suit rubbing his hands behind the tree.
You have read some. That there's no returning show that we're like, let's get back at it.
Yeah.
Let's get back into it again. We can pick up some threads that
these
were
last
left
few weeks have told us we don't need shows, though, you know? And me.
Chris, I've known that the whole time.
How to Blow Up a Pipeline. I basically asked Andy to watch this because...
And we're not going to spoil the movie, right?
No.
We're going to like make a case
for it. We'll just set up a little bit about it. But it's on Hulu now, came out earlier this year, or I think it's actually a 22 theatrical release.
It's a 22 film, but I feel like it was picking up momentum.
Yeah, and it had a VOD moment and now is on Hulu and is available to anybody with a Hulu account to just check this out. Please check it out. There are certain things where I'm just like, this is an important movie. This is a fucking thrilling movie. Like they essentially made this movie that's about eco-terrorism, I suppose, for lack of a better phrase, or activism that borders on terrorism. They made it in the style of like Traffic or you know, like a really well-done Steven Soderbergh movie, a really well-done thriller. And it is absolutely electrifying. The score is incredible. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the performances and some of the content. But for people who don't know what it's about, it's an adaptation of a book of the same name. But really more drawing like a lot of the same like ideas out of the book and then strapping a narrative to it.
Because the book is a nonfiction book, basically arguing that the planet is on fire.
Right. This would be it's like Linklater adapting Fast Food Nation.
Yes. Saying the ethos of the book is being like, it is moral to take any extreme action necessary to fight an immoral system that is ruining the planet.
Yeah, so you basically see this group of six people brought together by differing circumstances, but all with a common kind of villain in their lives, and that villain being like the fossil fuel industry and big corporations that are literally poisoning them in one way or another. And it's just one of those movies that I think realizes that like you don't, if just because the subject matter is serious doesn't mean that the filmmaking can't have energy and verve. What did you think of it?
Well, I thought you should say the piece that you said to me that I thought was really compelling, which is that separate and apart from the ethics of the movie, which mm-hmm. are worth talking about, this is a very well-crafted thriller.
Mm-hmm.
It pays attention in a way that makes it seem... We talk about this in TV a lot too, I think, when you can see the lines, you can see the string, but you don't mind the trick. You know, it understands genre filmmaking in a way that I think really suits the material, because that way it doesn't become preachy, it just becomes sensational, literally meaning it is sensation. There are sensations
yes.
that are impossible not to feel. We haven't mentioned, I think, the name of the director, Daniel Goldhaber,
yeah.
right, who had made the movie Cam.
Yes.
Which that was good. I don't know. I remember hearing yeah. about it.
He's got chops, man. Like, he is really good.
And I thought this movie was terrifying in a good way. I think that its engagement with the world as it is, and particularly with quite legitimate fears and gripes and grievances by younger people,
yeah.
is an incredible engine for a otherwise relatively straightforward A to B to C with some flashbacks to fill in the character's story. I do want to talk about some of the performances, but I also just want to say how thrilling it was to see a movie that was just so, or to see any piece of scripted content that just was about right now and reminding you how much story there is to be mined from the moment that we're in.
Yeah.
And also, not just, I don't want to be negative and be like, you know, let's stop retreating to our worlds of superheroes and dragons.
No, but Catherine Van Arendonk has a piece on Vulture today that's like from the fall preview for New York Magazine, mm-hmm. and I think is like, it's a very backwards looking TV slate for the fall.
Yes, well, I think most entertainment is, and this is kind of draws into the point that I was trying to make about Ahsoka, which is just like this, and multiversal storytelling, which is just about people being so freaked out about what's around the corner that we're just going to try to fix everything that came before, as mm-hmm. if that's somehow going to lead to better effects in the future. We can somehow change the future if we had made better choices, and we can do that as opposed to dealing with the reality. There's a deep undercurrent. Someone, if anyone's alive on a burning planet to write this, will write a piece about that, right? Like there's such an underlying pessimism in this generation of superhero storytelling, because none of them anymore are suggesting that you can fix the world through existing in it.
Yeah.
They're all suggesting you need
to go back.
Dr. fucking Strange to be like, okay, it'll be fine. It'll be fine if only we admit that Paul Giamatti was the Rhino. And,
right.
And we all agree, then somehow it'll work out. But it also made me think that, like, I don't know if they're our favorite, like in a blanket statement, but the shows that we have been most engaged with over the past year or two, whether it's Succession or Industry or The Bear
or Reservation Dogs. Yeah.
Those are all shows in the present.
Yep.
Now, they are not necessarily, in fact, they are decidedly not about climate apocalypse.
No.
But they're in the moment.
This is about climate apocalypse, but I think you could call this movie How to Rob a Bank or How to Whatever. Like, I think that How to Blow Up a Pipeline and the sort of ecological, like the eco-anxiety that all these mm-hmm. characters are experiencing in different ways is pretty prescient and relevant, obviously,
totally.
To everybody's lives. But even if you are like, I'm kind of like, I'm not even that well versed in what's going on like in climate change. I don't know.
Like, even Vivek would feel like this is an entertainment movie.
Yeah, but we should shout out some of the performers. I was particularly...
But we should. But I don't know if we officially said that, like, this is a movie about five or six young people from all over the country and different walks of life who get together in a very modern way, like through the internet,
yeah.
through finding each other over various means to perform the titular act of
yes.
ecoterrorism.
Of a specific pipeline that they have identified as all, like... is like responsible for a lot of their sort of misery and this mm-hmm. like they or would be responsible for the same kind of misery that they have experienced if they want to do something
big.
And I think it's worth mentioning Ariella Barr. At first, she plays a woman named Soshi in the movie, and she also has a co-screenwriting. Mm-hmm. She co-wrote the movie itself. She's pretty captivating as essentially the lead, although this is an ensemble piece. But I was kind of blown away by
you might know her from Runaways.
All right. Yeah, I was pretty blown away by this guy, Forrest Goodluck, who plays a character named Michael and is kind of the driving force of a lot of the action in the film. It is definitely the most unfussily militant, I would describe him, of all the characters in the show or in the movie, and is pushing the ball forward the most. But his performance, which combines like a kind of real minimal stoicism, but also like in his eyes and in his like actual like personage, like just a ton of like, you can just tell he's carrying all this baggage with him, and he just does an incredible job in this movie.
I mean, it's interesting to think about it as a comparison to like a heist movie where you're like, part of the fun, even if the tone is light, is they all have to have skin in the game.
Mm-hmm.
Why are they doing this? Why are they risking everything for the one big score? And in a heist movie, it's generally money. But in this, the movie does a really remarkable job in relatively modest sketches of making us understand and believe why these young people would do something like
yeah.
this, would risk everything for something.
It's a revenge movie.
It's a revenge movie, but there's also, it does speak to a kind of very, very current, very relevant feeling of powerlessness.
Yeah.
And I also think, I don't think this was necessarily the goal, but in some of the casting, like casting Marcus Scribner as Sean, Marcus Scribner you would recognize from like 8 seasons of Black-ish. And then he's in this movie, and so he's famous in a very normal way.
Yeah, like Christine Forseth is famous in a very normal way as well. She was in the Josh Schwartz show.
Yes, she's like Ariella, she's a Josh Schwartz graduate. She also, by the way, is the star of the upcoming unfinished Edith Wharton adaptation.
I know.
So don't put some respect on her name. The R comes before the O. But you think of them one way, and then you put them in this movie, and you, like, what would, he's not playing the kid from Black-ish, but this type of fear and anger could go anywhere.
Yeah.
I think that was a smart decision.
Oh, is it Froseth, not Forseth?
It's Froseth.
Well, you know, if you ever want to just jump in on the doc here and correct my spelling before we start recording.
This is the first time you've ever shared a doc with me.
That's not true.
It's refreshing.
Often I will be like, here's the list of stuff.
You must send it to my burner.
So, highly recommend.
Sasha
Lane is excellent in this film. Lucas Cage is excellent in this film. But obviously, I think Andy was like shaken up by it. I was exhilarated by it. I was just like, there are still like really fantastically energetic young filmmakers and performers who are willing to make stuff about how we are alive today.
I totally agree. And the movie doesn't make anything, it makes the act of making the movie seem relatively straightforward and easy. And one of the smartest decisions it makes is, and I don't think this is a spoiler, it does not show the larger world effects of their action or lack of action. We won't spoil anything.
No.
It's not about that. There is a...
It's a process movie.
It's a process movie that fundamentally understands in a way that is crushing, and I was reacting to that too, that maybe all action is hopeless.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's not, but maybe it is.
This is your opportunity to read the great books in Belarus.
I think so. Also, I drive an electric car, so I'm fine.
Oh, you're good?
You're welcome.
Guess who produced this episode of the Watch Podcast?
Let's take a moment and say it.
It's Kaya McMullen.
Say the name.
Back from the Grand Tour. Kaya, I hope you enjoyed. I mean, I know you've been listening to the Watch nonstop on vacation, but I hope you had a great time back here.
We know
I
Kaya
did. It was
time.
Lovely. I'm definitely not at all jet lagged and very just like honed in right now.
Yeah.
Well, that's why it's great that you work with us on a podcast that is just so tightly scripted and really follows a straight line.
That's right.
You guys make my job easy.
You know what? Again, twice in one show. You're welcome.
Everybody will be back on Thursday. Will we be talking about Ahsoka?
Will we?
I don't know.
Wow. Let's leave them hanging. We don't know.
Yeah. It's part of the fun.
I mean, there might be news breaking on Deadline, like someone else joining OnlyFans, right? So like there's tons of content for us to choose from. Frankly, it's possible.
Thanks to Kai for producing. We'll be back on Thursday. Take care.